walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Jason Colby, an environmental and international historian and professor at the University of Victoria. He's also an author, most recently of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator, a fascinating examination of the recent history of killer whales, including what becomes an extended profile of Ted Griffin, the first person to swim and perform with a captive orca. In tracing the arc of recent orca history, Colby introduces a squad of salty dogs and other colorful characters while mindful of taking care of some family business. His father, John Colby, participated in capturing killer whales for various operations, including SeaWorld, and has long felt tormented by it. We'll delve into various aspects of this rich history, very much including the family storyline, when I speak with Dr. Jason Colby in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Diane Kuhn, one of the organizers of the 9th Annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest, taking place this Saturday, November 3rd, at Perry Harvey Senior Park. We'll hear about what's all in store for Saturday. One thing we may talk about is the vegan mac and cheese contest, for which I'm one of the judges. I'm pretty sure I can't be bribed, but maybe I just haven't received a generous enough offer yet. Stand by. Also, speaking of VegFest, I'll be there much of the day roaming around, hanging out at the WMNF table, checking out all kinds of vendors, etc. But I am planning to give away a bunch of Talking Animals t-shirts. So if you see a geezer in a Talking Animals t-shirt, it's a good chance it'll be me. Say hello, get your own Talking Animals t-shirt if you'd like one. Lastly, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune later today, I'll be offering tickets to see Amanda Shires November 11th at the Capitol Theater. Right now, though, let's get to Dr. Colby with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Jason Colby on Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Colby.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. And as I joked to a friend who was hosting the morning show, I, of course, have dressed up today as an orca. It's quite a cumbersome outfit, a costume for Halloween, but I think it looks pretty good.
I'm too bad I can't see you.
I know. It's not great. Radio isn't a great medium to show my spectacular black and white luminous costume, but maybe we'll get some kind of picture up somehow. Anyways, congratulations on the book. In fact, at first I thought it'd be funny to say I haven't gotten around to reading the book just yet, but figured only you and maybe three other people would get that joke. So let me reiterate that I really enjoyed Orca and learned a great deal from it. I would say anyone interested in captive orcas at SeaWorld and other marine parks will find this book an illuminating read. Let me start with a fundamental question. Your academic wheelhouse, as it were, is environmental and international history, while your previous book was kind of miles and miles from orca territory. So this wasn't really telegraphed necessarily. What was the impetus for writing Orca?
There's sort of the standing joke among writers is there's two kinds, ones that admit that they're doing autobiography and ones that deny it, you know. This obviously came, as you said in your opening remarks, from some deep family history and family baggage. And so I'd say that this is the book that I was always sort of born to write and intending to write, but I had to be in the right place in my life to sort of work through the meaning of this for my region and how it's changed for our relationship with orcas and all cetaceans, but also for this family history that's been a point of both pride and pain, for ever since I was a little boy.
Yeah, so given that history, of course, was always there, how did you sort through that history relative to your academic career, your writing, et cetera, and how did you, more to the point, maybe arrive at the decision like, okay, now's the time, now I'm ready?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say that one of the reasons that it took me so long to get to the project is that I mean, first of all, I had to get a lot of people to open up to me, and so that was actually a very long process, including my own father. But figuring out a way to position myself in the story and to help my readers understand this in a way that didn't, you know, really center the story on my father and on the family history. And so really, because he wasn't a central part of the story in the way that Ted Griffin was, as you said in your opening remarks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I ultimately decided, you know, I'm a trained professional historian, you know, I've got to write this and research it a certain way, but it wouldn't be honest to my readers to try to obscure this personal connection. And in fact, you know, as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized that, you know, the only way to really explain to myself and to my readers where I was coming from is to make this connection. And so, you know, in many ways, the connection to my father is really, if not the narrative arc, the moral arc of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it tries to show those connections between, you know, the pain and regret, but also closes, I hope, with a note of hope that we all need right now.
Yeah, and I guess I should sort of elaborate on what you just described about sorting through and figuring out what sort of part your dad's story would play in the overall book, by way of noting that the opening sentences of the book are about your dad, having only seen him cry three times, once at his own father's funeral, and the other two occasions involved dead orcas. So, I mean, that's a pretty powerful note on which to sort of launch the book, and that we know that however major or not major a role your dad's going to play in the book, he's obviously going to be threading through there somewhere or another.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't have, I have a hard time imagining I would have come to the project without that connection to him. I also have a hard time believing that many of the people that chose to spoke to me would have spoken to me as openly without that connection. You know, certainly it was a really important part of getting Ted Griffin to talk to me was this family history and understanding some of the kind of complexities and sort of tragedy with respect to these animals that this history involved. And, you know, a lot of people, it's a deeply charged issue, and you know, it's a deeply charged issue across the United States and Canada and even around the world, but certainly in this region, in the Pacific Northwest. And so people are pretty tight-lipped. People that were involved in this industry, you know,
yeah,
40, 50 years ago are pretty tight-lipped and nervous about talking.
Well, that's among the things that I think are notable about the book, is that there are, first of all, there's a number of people that you talk to. I mean, again, the book is really rich, and you certainly go deep and you go wide. But one of the things that I was going to get into a bit later, but since you just said about how your dad's history enabled you probably more successfully to speak with Ted Griffin and others, what really is a kind of a bit of a running theme, at least amongst many of those you speak with, obviously your dad and Ted Griffin, we'll come back to Ted more specifically, I'm sure, momentarily, but was just this ongoing theme of anguish and regret that many of these people had about what role they played in capturing orcas and kind of effectively launching the industry that we now know at SeaWorld and a number of other parks elsewhere.
Yeah, and I'd say that, you know, one of the challenges for the book was to contextualize that, you know, as a historian, because I don't think any of that, I mean, there, I definitely met and talked to figures in the story that wished they could go back to their younger selves and intervene. I think my dad probably falls in that category, but a lot of what I was trying to do was to contextualize, you know, how transformative live capture was. We now know that you know, the damage it did, especially to this small population, the southern resident killer whales in the Salish Sea of the Northwest, that we now know is this, you know, this small resident population, as we call it. But at the time, no one had any idea. You know, there was no science really on orca populations. There's certainly, I mean, the only science that was done on the West Coast or anywhere in the United States was the kill and dissect variety. And so at the time, you know, one of the things I try to show is that, you know, at the time, the debate was not between, you know, whale watching and whale catching. It was between whale killing and whale catching. And so this whole paradigm of interacting with live orcas close up was something new under the sun. And at the time, to many involved felt progressive. I know that's hard for people to believe, but you know, studying orcas instead of shooting them and cutting them open, or you know, interacting with them as individuals, did seem like a watershed moment. At the same time, you know, with the passage of time, as we came to know more about, you know, how limited this population was and how much damage had been done, but also as they became more iconic in the region, there was really this sort of moral reframing of it that, you know, captivity in part helped create. But a lot of these people now have to wrestle with these changes, and it's hard. You know, it's certainly hard for my dad, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was one thing that struck me also in the opening paragraphs, really, of your book, was this notion of how the captivity element in many ways ultimately helped save and preserve them.
Yeah, and it's a hard place for a lot of people to get to, because we're sort of looking back at this history, you know, from the perspective of a change that many of us don't realize even happened. I mean, that you know, we certainly, people in the Northwest here, but really around North America, assume people have always loved orcas, right? And how could these people catch them? You know, shouldn't they feel awful about this? At the time, you know, orcas are being killed by the hundreds and thousands, you know, every year around the world, by fishermen, by whalers, by just people, you know, shooting at them for fun, and as I said, by scientists. And so it's funny that when I talk to scientists about this, and I, you know, sort of floated that sense that, you know, captivity helped transform science and people's relations. I mean, they sort of stared at me and said, "Well, yeah, of course, duh." Yeah. But you know, for many people who now are in the perspective of, you know, being against captivity and you know, especially pro animal rights, not so much conservation but animal rights, I mean, that notion of captivity as having generated anything positive is really hard to entertain. And I'm, you know, a lot of what I'm doing in this book is showing how the process of change happens and how it happened, and certainly to some degree, hopefully helping different generations of people understand each other. You know, one of the most powerful things Ted Griffin said to me after reading the book, which I you know, really one of the most meaningful things anyone has said to me, is that, you know, he said, you know, for the first time after reading this book, I now understand why people were protesting me.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's something you don't necessarily get to expect to get as a writer.
Well, no, I think among the things that really struck me about the book, and as your comments here really struck me anew in that way, is that in contrast to, let's say, even a marine biologist, or certainly somebody that maybe identifies as a animal rights, animal welfare person, the fact that you wrote this and you are a historian and that's how you've trained and studied and written, I think made the story so much more powerful and informative, to the extent where one of the pivotal figures, i.e. Ted Griffin, who we will come back to, I promise, in a moment, more detail, could learn about what happened in his own story effectively from your book.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, that's in some ways the challenge I set out to do, and I, you know, any writer has limitations based on their training. You know, I'm not a biologist, so I really had to, you know, dig into the science and talk to scientists to really help understand that process better. But there were other things that, you know, came more naturally to me, I think, understanding the complexities of people's lives and historical context and how change happens. Yeah.
This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Jason M. Colby, historian, professor, and author, most recently of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. If you'd like to ask Dr. Colby a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. So we've got one caller who's been holding quite some time. Let's get them involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Jason Colby.
Yes, thank you. You know, Dr. Colby, you are ideally suited to expose and explore the largest macro picture of human interaction with nature, because I see that you were in commercial fishing, you were in fish farming. There's also those other connections where people close to you were exploiting and harming animals. And as a historian, and I note that you've written about imperialism and empire, today the WWF report came out and said that our species, in just the last two generations, has eradicated more than 60% of native flora and fauna worldwide. So in a historical perspective, can you take a look at the anthropogenic mass extinction event? Also, I'd like you to comment on the inherent harms of the whale-watching profiteer industry off of Vancouver Island, and also about why more people who have exploited and abused animals don't have a conscience change and repent and become advocates like you have become.
Wow, those are three big questions.
I think I might be out of a job.
The three big questions. Great.
Yeah.
First of all, one way to think about this book, is it part of the moral arc in connection with my father is what happened to the southern resident killer whales, which are one discrete population of Orcinus orca around the world, and they're critically endangered. And so this is one piece of the story of species and population eradication. And the caller is right, the caller is right that we are in the midst of a extraordinary extinction event that is being driven by people and the changes that we've brought to the world. And there are big picture climate change, acidification of the oceans. These are, certainly more existential threats to species and to all of us than the story I'm writing about. But it is a really critical issue. I mean, and by some estimates, this is these are all different scientific estimates. But between 70 and 80 species go extinct each day. We're in the midst of a crisis, and it feels like our consumer world is whistling past the graveyard as it's going on. And so, absolutely, this is a piece of the story, but I don't make any claims to with orca that I'm writing the definitive book about this extraordinary mass extinction we're seeing. The other question about whale watching, I'll try to go through these really quickly. The other question about whale watching, I'd say that industry is, it's a progressive change over whaling, which was the defining, interaction of people, in world history for much of the last 300-400 years. And so the quest to find sustainable whale watching practices is, ongoing as this industry continues to grow. It certainly poses a threat and has posed a threat in terms of acoustic pollution, harassment, and such. The flip side is, of course, that there's a reality that many people are able to see whales close up who would not otherwise be able to do that. And there's good evidence that this does make many of them more invested in survival. And so there is a question of if you're not able to see whales in any way other than through television and documentaries, how do you get people invested? So that's the ongoing debate. And I'm forgetting his third question. Should I dive into that? Or
to be honest, I should have written them down. I'm kind of forgetting the third one as well. But
I think his last question was about repentance. Was almost a sense of a sin and confession. Why don't more people feel repentance? I think he mentioned that I've been in commercial fishing and fish farming. Yeah, I've thought about the damage to ecosystems that we do through our extraction a lot in my life, I'd say that in order to move forward with these kind of discussions, we absolutely need to be willing to point to where damage is being done and admit our own damage. But I also think we need forgiveness toward those that have engaged in damaging practices in their lives. I think that's kind of how we move forward and to understand, and this is part of what I'm trying to do in this book, to understand that everybody lives their lives forward. Nobody lives their lives with the benefit of hindsight, and none of us know how people 50 years from now are going to judge our actions. I imagine that we're many of us engaging in behavior, certainly driving around in gas guzzling cars and eating meat, many of us, draining the oceans of fish still, that people 50 years from now will look back on with horror and wonder, how could they do this? How could they not have known better? That may sound like a cop-out, but I guess as a historian, I like to point out that, people are complex, and the decisions we make are always in the context of our, of our times.
And that might well be the perfect sort of entryway into Ted Griffin, because he does, we've sort of alluded to, I guess, already a couple times, he does emerge as a central figure in recent Orca history, and certainly a central figure in your book, not surprisingly then, and particularly, I guess, the history of performing orcas. But he's not just a central figure in the saga, but a really, I think, at least complex and certainly colorful one, and exactly some of the ways you were just talking about, both in response to the caller's questions and to some of your opening remarks in terms of people who did what they did. This goes back decades and live with all kinds of anguish and regrets. And in some cases, and you said that this was true for him, have gotten a much better framework and context for what they did through reading your book. But can you just talk a little bit about Ted, just because he is so monumental, really, in all this?
Yeah, so Ted Griffin was born in the 1930s. He's a lifelong from many generations of Northwesterners, and he was an entrepreneur. Started the first kind of real Seattle aquarium. It doesn't exist anymore. But it was called the Seattle Marine Aquarium on the waterfront in 1962 during the Seattle World's Fair, and. He became, after several encounters with orcas, just swimming and on boats, became obsessed with the idea of befriending an orca as he thought about it. And this seemed like an unthinkable idea to people at the time. Fishermen in Puget Sound and elsewhere routinely shooting at them, and as they admitted to him, scientists that he talked to said, well, the only way to interact with them is to shoot them like we do and cut them open. And he really became obsessed with the idea of interacting with the killer whale, bringing it into sort of human space to show people a different view, certainly to benefit as well, commercially at his aquarium. And eventually, after many different attempts, he managed to buy a large male orca who was accidentally captured by Canadian fishermen in northern BC, built a floating pen, brought this whale south, named the whale Mamu, and this became the first moment, to the shock of scientists and spectators and journalists, became the first moment that we know of, and likely the first moment that a human being has ever swum in close contact with an orca. And to the shock of many, this orca, this apex predator, didn't tear him apart. In fact, let him touch him and eventually ride with him. Griffin, it's really extraordinary pictures of Griffin, taking naps on Nemo's back and such. And in hindsight, lots of people see this rightfully see this as the origin point of the orca captivity industry, which is very much very controversial now. But at the time, this is an absolute reframing of the way people thought about this kind of what was at the time viewed as a menacing, violent vermin species. That was sort of source of fear among divers and boaters and fishermen. And so, there's a big write-up in National Geographic. Many of the orca scientists who are now sort of modern wild orca researchers I spoke to talked about Ted Griffin and this article in National Geographic as their aha moment where they decided they wanted to study whales. And so it's a transformative moment. But Griffin goes on, so Nemu goes on to perform the Seattle waterfront with Griffin, first human orca shows, dies of pollution in Seattle's harbor a year later, and Griffin goes on after that to feed the demand or meet the demand for captive orcas that Nemu and his shows had created. He sells the first orca to SeaWorld, who's named Shamu, which is literally at the time Shamu. Mm-hmm. And eventually it goes on to capture dozens of orcas in local waters, several of whom die accidentally. I should point out they were attempting to keep them alive, but some drown in nets and such. And he was eventually sort of driven to retire because of the rising public protest and such, and so the role he plays in the book for me is kind of as this certainly a fascinating character. He was viewed at the time as Mr. Killer Whale, the sort of pivotal figure in this story.
Yeah,
but I really wanted to understand the role that an individual plays in this transformation, but also how the the environmental, you know, the changes in environmental culture and views of cetaceans that he had participated in and contributed to could actually sort of sweep up someone and change the context around them to the point where they become then the villains rather than the heroes. And it's sort of a fascinating arc his life takes in just a short time.
Yeah, well, that, again, part of what I find so fascinating about the book and the Ted Griffin part, and again, noting that he's a really complex human being, is that, as you mentioned in sort of giving his story, he at least comes across initially as totally an animal lover guy, obsessed, especially against a backdrop where orcas were these mad predators and awful things that would rip people apart and were totally nutso and unpredictable. He does have this obsession with befriending one. And then, as you say, these things happened that it seemed like he was just sort of almost leaping from one thing to the next, and he had nothing to go by. And the next thing you know, yeah, he is helping capture all these orcas and getting SeaWorld set up with their first of many Shamus. And that's where later, I think, probably the regret and anguish kicks in. But again, you do such an amazing job of really portraying a guy who was an animal lover first and probably would claim now still is.
I'm glad you brought that up, that theme, because I think the one of the hardest things for a lot of people who are deeply critical and, you know, understandably so, of the captivity industry and its history, they have a heart, and that comes from a place for most of them of being, you know, animal lovers, you know, and deep you know, commitment to humane and moral treatment of animals. It's very hard to accept that the people that played the roles in a story like this were coming from a similar place. And I know that some listeners may scoff at that very notion, but it's true that you know, the way to be an animal lover and an animal person, you know, there's not necessarily one path. And at the time, if you're talking about the mid-1960s, you know, my dad, one of the very first things he told me about, you know, his training as a biologist was that, you know, the difficulty in at college of the fact that you were expected to go out and shoot animals and cut them up. That was the expectation. That's how you did research, and his kind of ethical wrestling with this, that he just couldn't bring himself to kill animals. This whole paradigm of scientific research as the only way you interact with animals and study them is to go out and kill them. Well, you know, Griffin, I think, experienced this very, very similar thing. You know, he's talking to scientists, well, how do I get closer to one of these whales? And the scientists universally said, you don't get close to them, they'll tear you apart. The only way to do it is to harpoon them, and then we study them that way. And so, you know, if you understand that someone like Ted Griffin is coming from a place, and this is, you know, true of his whole life, you know, of a sort of obsessive quest to connect with animals at every stage in his life, then you understand that's in many ways what's driving him. I think it's really easy to, in hindsight, look at a figure like this and sort of put the black hat on them and the horns on them and say, he's driven by profit. You know, it's called commercialism. But, you know, the truth of the matter is he never made a massive amount of money off of this, right? I mean, he made a living, and it's certainly that living cost the orcas of the Salish Sea dearly, you know, in ways that nobody understood at the time. But you know, much of what drove him, and also ultimately much of what drove him out, was a love of animals. I mean, I think, you know, one thing I try to show in the book is that this experience, this year he has with Nemo, is the most intense, extraordinary experience of his life. And in many ways, he could never replicate that in the rest of his life. And when Nemo dies on the waterfront, Ted Griffin is shattered in a sort of existential way. And never really finds himself, well, not I wouldn't say never finds himself again, but struggles to find himself again and who he wants to be after losing that love of his life in many ways, this whale. And you know, one of the things I try to show, whether successfully or not, is that, you know, when we have that kind of damage to ourselves emotionally and psychologically, we can find our way down paths that you know, we look back on and regret to a degree. And that's you're trying to bring the human story out in something like this.
Yeah. Well, again, NAMU, again, this was so early. This was just when that world, for better or worse, of captive orcas and performing orcas was still just being forged, really. So for him, NAMU, he never saw as a meal ticket. He saw this animal that I've connected with on a very profound level. And yeah, I'm sure it was nothing short of shattering. And yeah, he did go on to capture other whales. And you know, I think probably some of what inspired him initially got lost, which is probably how he got lost.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And you know, he has a line. I credit Ted for being willing to open up, you know, to me. This is a guy that when I met him was in his late 70s, you know, he's in his early 80s now. This is, you know, 40 years ago, a lot of what we were talking about, it took years to build this relationship to the point where he would open up about some of the tragedies, like the Penn Cove tragedy. But, you know, I think it really that one of those breakthrough moments was, you know, as I sat with him and he said, you know, to himself, or to me, that you know, in hindsight, after NAMU died, that he wanted to become a different person. He wanted to get away from himself. He couldn't, in a sense, he wasn't willing to fall in love again, so to speak. He wasn't willing to invest emotionally, which you know is the way that a lot of us deal with heartbreak, right?
It's, yeah,
is the kind of shelling up. And he's a guy that, you know, like many men in that generation, you know, have a hard time talking about their feelings, have a hard time dealing with regrets. And you know, I give him all the credit in the world for being willing to open up to me about this. It made the book. It wouldn't have been the book that it became, for better or for worse, without his willingness to do that.
Yeah. And I would think, too, as a historian by trade, it must be, well, in this case, well, sort of essential, but also exhilarating in a way to undertake a project which at least some of the key figures you'll be writing about are still alive and that you can sit down and talk with them.
Absolutely. I mean, this was, you know, my first book about United Fruit Company in Central America. Everybody's dead. And so one of the really rich, extraordinary experiences in this book, and I try to bring it to the readers. I mean, I try to be sort of a guide and almost a tour guide through some of this, hopefully having the readers feel like it, at least at some points, like they're sitting there with me and in these conversations. And this was the most exhilarating, exciting, challenging experience as a historian I've ever had, because the other thing is, you know, when people are dead and when you're just, you know, mostly researching documents and dusty archives, you know, people don't sit down with you or write you emails or call you on the phone and say, you know, I think you're misunderstanding my life, or I didn't really mean to do that, or that's not what I did. You know, they don't contest the meaning of their lives with you. And so, you know, on the one hand, it's a really rewarding, amazing experience to have people open up their lives and their memories. It's a leap of faith people take in talking to someone. But at the same time, you know, memory is a fickle thing, you know, and the memories don't always line up with the documents, and people want to remember their actions usually in a rosier way. I mean, that's another sort of way I give kudos to Ted, you know, for you know, a lot of the things that he did that I disagree with, you know, and we're not in the same place, you know, politically necessarily, but unlike several people I talked to, he didn't ever try to sugarcoat his actions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact opened up about some of the tragedies and, you know, sad concealments that had happened that no one knew about until the book came out. And so, you know, the fact that he was willing to do that, meant that he was actually committed to helping me write a good piece of history. And you know, we're just talking about him, but there's lots of other characters, lots of other figures in the book who did that as well. You know?
Yeah. Well, it also... Go ahead.
I was just going to say really quickly, you know, one of my favorite interviews is just in really in one chapter, chapter 11, called The White Whale, about former researcher named Don White, you know, who has some of the most moving and emotional passages in the book about how interactions with captive orcas reframed his way of thinking about not just animals, but people. And I walked out of those two interviews with him really rethinking my own, you know, priorities and moral framework and even interpretation of the book. So that's what I loved, too, about these interviews.
Yeah. Well, too, whether it's Ted White or Don White, Ted Griffin or Don White, again, part of what I was saying before this ties into is that these guys are alive, but they are also closer probably to the end of their lives. So there's a certain reckoning that I think was probably going on when you had these kind of conversations, especially after building some trust and saying that your own father obviously had part of that same experience and making that kind of link.
Absolutely. And I think we all sort of view our own actions, you know, differently at different stages of our lives. And I think that it was a really, I mean, maybe I'll take this moment to say it was a really healthy, painful, but a healthy process for me and my dad, too. I mean, I think my dad was deeply reluctant to, I mean, not that he had a choice in this piece of it, but he tried to discourage me from doing the project. I mean, he thought that it was too controversial, that not enough people would talk to me, that you know, readers would misunderstand what I was doing. Ultimately, you know, I convinced him that I had to do it. You know, it's a book that I had to write, and I think it's been a really powerful healing process for him.
Oh wow!
In a way that I don't think I anticipated. I mean, I've had some really wonderful exchanges with him since the book's come out, and we've had our, like any father and son, we've had our close times and our distant times, and it definitely brought us closer together, which has been wonderful because I think it helped him find some peace about a part of his life that was both extraordinarily exciting, but in retrospect, you know, really painful.
And so that's interesting that he sort of discouraged you from doing it, and yet the fact that you are John Colby's son also really, in some ways, enabled you to write it, at least to get the people that made the book work to speak with you.
It definitely got me some interviews that I wouldn't have gotten. I've had reviewers and even people, you know, in audiences that I've spoken to say, well, don't you think you shouldn't have written this because of your dad's role? You can't be objective. I sort of say it. You know, I usually respond to that by saying, well, you know, first of all, I've never really met a human being that's entirely objective. We're not robots. I mean, our own experiences and training and such, you know, frame how we approach topics or even ask questions. But I would say that, you know, somebody else would have dealt with this material differently. We're all human. But I think that the personal connection gave me an entry, not just into the interviews, for a lot of these interviews, but also I think into the emotional and as well as the professional and work world of a lot of these men, mostly men, that has been mostly closed off. And so it's certainly a piece of this story of our transformed relationship with this apex predator and with cetaceans that I think nobody's really tried to dig into in this way. And so in that sense, the relationship, the connection to my dad made it possible.
Yeah. Well, I have another question too about your dad, but let me let folks know that this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Jason M. Colby, a professor at the University of Victoria, historian and author. His new book is Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. We're in our final few moments, but if you would like to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So I'd be curious to know, given some of the resistance to your writing the book and whatever struggles, you know, surrounded that and preceded that, that you had with your dad, if there were some sort of parallel responses to, you had noted that Ted Griffin really got some insights from the book in terms of how people were viewing what he did and objecting to what he did. Did your dad come away from the book with some views and perspectives and insights that he just hadn't arrived at previously?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he, like so many of the people that sat down with me and opened up their lives and lived through a lot of this history, I think they thought they knew more of the story than it turns out that they did. So one way, and this isn't just about perspective, it's sort of about context and the span of this historical transformation. I think, you know, my father and many of the other interviewees who read the book sent me notes and called me essentially saying, you know, my God, I had no idea about this, or I had no idea about that, or I'd never heard of this. And certainly the deeper history I dig into toward the beginning of the book about human violence toward orcas, you know, scientific violence, you know, whaling, just, you know, the violence of fishermen and the remaking of the marine ecosystem in the Northwest long before any of the captures. I think that was a piece of the story that very few of them knew. I think that some of the stories of the captures and you know, what happened and how some of the animals were lost really brought out some emotions, certainly for my father. And you know, the piece I would add, maybe this is kind of a spoiler a little bit for the book, but you know, in the process of going through the research, I discovered, you know, to my horror and to my dad's horror, that the four whales, one was released, but the three whales who were kept in the captures my dad conducted for Sealand of the Pacific in 1973 were actually the last three southern resident killer whales taken from the wild for captivity. And you know, he didn't know that at the time. Didn't know that 45 years later. And you know, one of the little tidbits that no one except, you know, my dad and those in the operation knew was that they had many more whales behind the net that they were about to take, and sort of a random explosion from an army depot nearby spooked the whales and who took off out of the bay. And it would have been, you know, my dad lived with regrets of these three whales that he took out and who all died in captivity, but you know, it would have been a far greater tragedy. You know, and he actually sent me a text shortly before this interview about a dream he had had that, you know, that detonation hadn't happened and that the whales had been lost. And so I think that, you know, if you think about the kind of counterfactuals, what might have happened, it could have been even greater tragedy. And so all of those pieces of the story, and so, you know, scientists had never heard that story, scientists that I talked to, you know, and realizing that, you know, that pod, L pod, could have been much more damaged than it was. This really brought out some of these stories that people really didn't, you know, even realize they had lived through.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say we have really less than a minute, but there was one question I was hoping to ask that's sort of peripheral, but obviously related. So I don't know if you can squeeze an answer into our short time, but I would just be curious to know what you thought of blackfish.
Well, I mean, blackfish definitely supercharged the issue of captivity, and you know, convinced many people that killer whales have to be saved from captivity. There's some errors in it. But I mean, it does reveal some of the damage that you know, captivity has done to orcas. I would say that, you know, a lot of what I'm trying to do with this book is to be a prequel to Blackfish, to explain why we give a rip in the first place about this apex predator that, you know, in a culture that has often eradicated predators, you know, why are we so fascinated and concerned, and so the story really tries to frame that. And but certainly it had a profound impact on my father. I mean, that moment where he just absolutely decided that there was nothing redeeming about captivity, and so it had a powerful effect on people.
No, I thought that was interesting. Now I'm going way over time, but just really briefly, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask at least what was one of the most major mistakes, errors that was in the film, and from your standpoint?
Well, I mean, the treatment of the early captures in the Northwest is sort of slipshod, and you know, some of the footage is misrepresented. I mean, there's footage of taken from the Northwest when they're discussing, you know, Iceland, and there's claims that SeaWorld captured orcas in the Northwest, which it actually never directly did remove any orcas there. You know, it was Northwesterners that did it. There, you know, some of the of the workplace accident stuff, which is really upsetting to see, you know, was some of that was actually communicated to workers in SeaWorld, but that doesn't minimize, you know, I would have to have longer period to sort of go into depth, but it doesn't minimize the overall message, which is that this certainly has done damage to psychologically and physically to the animals in captivity.
Right, and obviously had a profound effect on your dad's view of orcas in captivity too, so it brings it all around. So, Jason, we are just about out of time. We've been speaking with Dr. Jason Colby. Again, the book is Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. Wherever you get your books, it's available. Jason Colby, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals.
Thanks so much for having me on.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Later on the show, I'll speak with Diane Kuhn of the Tampa Bay Veg Fest, the 9th annual edition of this popular event happening this Saturday, although with some new wrinkles, including a new location. We'll hear about that and other details in just a moment. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. You know, for last week's discussion of Amendment 13, I had prepared a comedy piece, even though I figured the conversation would fill the whole hour, as it, of course, ended up doing. So this piece I picked out was Greyhound-related, but the intentional wrinkle was that it was not about the dogs, but about the bus. So we're going to hear that now. This is Tom Ryan with part of a piece called Greyhound in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I've been traveling a lot. I usually fly. Sometimes I take the train. Sometimes I drive. And every now and then, I take Greyhound. You're always forced into taking Greyhound. You know what their slogan should be? Oh, we'll get you there. But you're going to have to earn it. Man, I was on this one trip. I accidentally left one of those luggage tags on my bag from a previous flight that I had taken. This caused quite a stir on the bus. People were like, whoa, you've flown? What's it like? Well, you arrive on the same day. No way. Then this one guy is staring at my bag, wondering why it closes with a zipper and not a twist tie.
That was Tom Ryan with part of a piece called Greyhound, taken from his album Downtime Enthusiast. Now it's time to speak with Diane Kuhn of the Tampa Bay Veg Fest, happening this Saturday. Indeed, this is Diane Kuhn back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Let's jump right in. So let's jump in talking about the new details first, because there's a real biggie amongst the new details.
Yeah, there is. Well, what's happened is this is our ninth annual, and what's happened over the years is we have just gotten so big by attendees and vendors and the whole thing that we had to change parks. We had to go to a larger park, and we found a park. It's still in downtown Tampa. It's called Perry Harvey Senior Park. And that's where we've located. So that is probably our most important thing we want to get out there, is that we are not at the park we were at last year. We have changed.
Right. So bigger, better, and more parking, and the whole experience should be better this year.
Yeah. It's a beautiful park.
Yeah.
And it's organized very well. So we're looking forward to it. It's been fun and exciting, you know, getting it going. Little nervous. We're hoping that everybody finds us that morning, but I think they will. You can't miss it. You get over there and you'll see all the tents and the music. We have so much going on. It's going to be a great day.
Well, let's talk about, so we got a new location, and there's at least one or more other new wrinkles. Let's talk about one of those, the vegan mac and cheese contest.
Yeah, we wanted something to add something new, a little different this year, and we came upon this idea of doing this vegan mac and cheese cook-off, and it just took off. People just love the idea. We got ourselves, we opened it up only to 10 contestants this year because we weren't sure how it would go, but it's been a great success. So we're very excited, and we have our judges, which, of course, you are one of them, I'm very happy to say.
I know. I keep making sly references to being open to bribes, but so far I just haven't gotten a big enough offer yet, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And but it's going to be early in the morning, so if people want to get there and be part of, we're going to have a tasting. So if you want to, besides the judges, we're going to have a People's Choice Award. So if people want to get involved in that, they should get there early in the morning. I would say between 10 and 10:30.
Okay.
To get their tickets to be part of it.
Wow. Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
So let's, before we run out of time, there's so many things to talk about, and I'm afraid we're not going to get to all of them.
Yeah.
So let's talk about at least one or more of the speakers next.
Yeah. Well, we have, I really, really pleased with our speakers this year. We have a really diverse group. We have a couple physicians, plant-based physicians. We have, of course, Paul Watson from Sea Shepherd. We also have an athlete. We have a championship wrestler, Austin Aries, who's going to be there, who is a plant-based muscle wrestler. And we have also a dual waste. We have speakers on the environment and how to save the environment with being more cautious about how you do things in the environment.
Cool. So, and of course, in addition to that, we've got food vendors and other vendors and animal rescues. And I'm only saying this because we're sort of running out of time.
Yeah.
And there's stuff for kids and music, as you noted earlier. For people who want to find out more about these things that we haven't had a chance to delve into, give us the website and or Facebook action.
Sure. Well, our website is www.TampaBayVegFest.org.
Okay.
And then you can also, of course, get on Tampa Bay Veg Fest on Facebook. Easy to get to. It has all of everything that's going on. It's easy to follow. We have maps on the website now and on Facebook. We have information about parking. That's been a big question. Where do we park? We have all that on the Facebook page right now.
Great.
So they should be, you know, it's pretty easy to locate all that and find out what's going on.
Cool. Well, it's going to be really fun. I'm really looking forward to it. So, Diane, thanks for you're just swamped with preparation and stuff. So thanks for making the time to talk to us a little bit today about this Saturday's Veg Fest.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Loray and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lillet. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Meanwhile, on this show, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see Amanda Shires November 11th at the Capitol Theater. Right now, it's time to get into Name That Animal Tune, and this is our British Invasion edition of the show, because we have the British Invasion 4 happening this Saturday at Skipper's, where 16 of the best local bands portray British bands, in this case covering the period 75 through 79. So the Stones, the Sex Pistols, Dire Straits, Elvis Costello, so many more. It's all happening at Skipper's this Saturday, November 3rd, starting at 6 p.m. Info and tickets or at WMNF.org. So, if you haven't won something from WMNF in the last 90 days, you are eligible for this prize, a pair of tickets to see Amanda Shires November 11th at the Capitol Theater. The first person calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, which will be played Saturday night at Skipper's. It's the British Invasion edition of Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. If you could name that animal tune, we will take it off the air because we have just about reached the end of time. It's WMNF. It's Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Brandon Largo. NPR News is next.